Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, November 18, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to a special book edition of the Federalist Society Practice Group's telephone conference call. On today's call, we'll be discussing the new book, Sagebrush Rebel, Reagan's Battle with Environmental Extremists, and Why It Matters Today. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and also this call is being recorded for possible use as a podcast in the future. We welcome to today's call two outstanding panelists. The first is the author of the book in question today, Sagebrush Rebel. He is Mr. William Perry Pendley, President and Chief Operating Officer of the Mountain States Legal Foundation. He'll be joined by Mr. R. Timothy McCrum, partner at Crowell and Mooring. We're going to hear opening remarks from Perry Pendley of 20 minutes, and then some reactions from Mr. McCrum of about 10 minutes, and then we'll be turning to you, the audience, for questions. So please be ready with your questions. And with that, Mr. Pendley, the floor is yours.
Dean, thank you very much. I wrote Sagebrush Rebel, Reagan's Battle with Environmental Extremists and Why It Matters Today, for one reason, primarily, and that is because this story has never been told. I wish I could say that this is the best book on the topic. I have to say that it's the only book on the topic. Reagan really did have a remarkable record with regard to energy and natural resources issues, and my primary focus was on the Department of the Interior, which is where I was fortunate enough to serve President Reagan. Reagan once said, things are not always the way they seem. Only in Washington, D.C. would a department in charge of everything out of doors be called the Department of the Interior. So, he had a unique interest in the Department of Interior, which he is perhaps the most knowledgeable president in history about that agency, and he was for several reasons. The first was because he'd been a California governor, and we always think of California as L.A. and Hollywood and San Francisco, the cable cars, but in fact, California, like my current state of residence, Colorado, or my home state of Wyoming, half of the state is owned by the federal government. And so Reagan, as governor, dealt with the federal government. He dealt with those federal agencies that most people think are somewhat obscure. And he dealt with them in the unique way that a governor has to, not only as a sovereign, but also as a neighbor. The Park Service, the Fish and Wildlife Service, the Forest Service, the Corps of Engineers. And so he had that unique experience. The second thing that's unique about Reagan from the standpoint of his experience is that instead of going back into television as a former governor, he went into radio. He did have the opportunity to appear on the nightly news with Walter Cronkite and debate environmentalist or debate other prominent figures, but instead he chose radio. Marty Anderson has written two wonderful books or compiled two wonderful books of Reagan's radio addresses during that period, and to read those addresses, as I have, and I commend them to you, is to understand how knowledgeable Reagan was on these issues. During the 1970s, Reagan saw three issues as primary. They were the economy, energy, because its effect on the economy, and foreign affairs, once again, because of the effect of energy had on our relations with the Soviet Union. And so Reagan wrote about these issues. He made it very clear what he thought needed to be done on these issues. And then when he became president, it wasn't as if he went off and did his foreign affairs thing. He maintained a unique interest in what was going on at the agency. He appointed three cabinet officers, three secretaries, Jim Watt, Judge Clark, and then Donald Paul Hodel, people he knew who would carry out his programs. and he backed them, whatever backing they need, whatever support they needed. And furthermore, he paid very unique attention, I think, as a president to what was going on. Twice, for example, in 1983, when issues became controversial, Reagan sat down and handwrote his radio address for a week in June and a week in November to discuss what was going on at the Department of Interior, what was the record of the Reagan administration on environmental issues, and why the American people should have confidence in those activities. And so Reagan had a great record on all of these issues, which I'll discuss in a minute, but it's never been put forth, and so I wanted to make sure it was out there. The second reason I wrote the book was because environmentalists continue to misrepresent the Reagan record. Just to give an example, my good friend Gail Norton, when she was nominated by President George W. Bush to be Secretary of the Interior of the Sierra Club, said about her, she's just Jim Watt in a skirt. And I think the environmentalists had concluded that they had so effectively besmirched the character of the Reagan administration, and particularly Jim Watt, that all they had to do to tar the Bush administration was to say, well, it's just like Reagan. And the environmentalists misrepresent Reagan in three important perspectives. First of all, environmental groups today say, well, we never made up our mind about Ronald Reagan until after he became president, started doing things we didn't like. The fact of the matter is the environmentalists opposed Reagan even before he started running for office. In September or October of 1979, for example, environmental groups gathered together in Denver, Colorado, to figure out, strategize how they're going to deal with the Sagebrush Rebellion. For those who don't know, the Sagebrush Rebellion at the time was a bipartisan opposition, and we're talking about several Western governors who were Democrats: Lamb of Colorado, Matheson of Utah, Babbitt of Arizona, Hirschler of Wyoming, who did not like what Jimmy Carter was doing, did not like what Cecil Andrews was doing, and it gave rise to what we call the Sagebrush Rebellion. And environmentalists understood that this was a major problem for them. Reagan was unabashed in saying he was a Sagebrush rebel. So the environmentalists in October of 79 tried to figure out what were they going to do about the Sagebrush Rebellion. Then the environmentalists went one step further in September of 1980, when they gathered together at the White House, 21 environmental groups, and endorsed Jimmy Carter. They not only endorsed Jimmy Carter, they stepped out onto the White House lawn and scoriated Ronald Reagan. New York Times said it was unprecedented for environmental groups to take side in a presidential election. The second area in which environmentalist groups misrepresent the Reagan record is they say he was a successful administrative president, and scholars all say that he was one of the most, if not the most, successful administrative president. And I lay out in my book exactly how he did it, how he took control. Reagan often said every once in a while, you got to grab the bureaucracy by the throat and say, shake it, and say, stop doing what you're doing. And Reagan was very successful at that. But environmental groups say he was not a successful legislative president, simply because he was so much at odds with the bipartisan consensus regarding the environmental issues that existed in Congress. And that's untrue. Reagan was not at odds with Congress. Congress was at odds with itself on these issues: energy issues, mineral issues, development issues, wilderness issues. Congress was positively schizophrenic. Some in Congress wanted to continue to drill for oil and gas in wilderness areas. Someone wanted to stop immediately, even though drilling was permitted through 1984. Notwithstanding that, Reagan had a very successful legislative agenda, passing a number of federal laws. I lay them out in my book, and they're worthy of note. And so when environmental groups say Reagan was not successful legislatively, he was indeed successful. And the third manner in which environmentalists misrepresent the Reagan record is by continuing to attack the Reagan record as if President Reagan laid waste to the wildlands and the great beauties that we have in this country. And I understand environmental groups' opposition to President Reagan with regard to oil and gas offshore, oil and gas onshore, coal development. Certainly, he did things environmental groups did not like. But the fact of the matter is, he also did many things environmental groups should be laudatory about. He signed more wilderness laws than any president in history. He brought in more private land into the federal estate for parks and wildlife refuges than any president in history. And he spent $1 billion in restoring the national parks. He put an end, or tried to put an end, to the acquisition of private lands to enter into the federal estate for park purposes. He thought the parks were as big as they needed to be, but he did not think that the parks were in good condition. And in fact, three GAO reports, General Accounting Office reports, concluded that the parks were not up to code. And so Reagan put in the budget $1 billion spread over 4 years to restore the parks. So I can understand environmental groups saying, well, we don't like his OCS program where he made available for lease in the entire Outer Continental Shelf, all 1 billion acres. We don't like his desire to approve applications for permit to drill, to increase exploration on federal onshore lands. I can understand their opposition to his changing the regulations with regard to the reclamation of coal, consistent with what Congress wanted, and his strategic and critical minerals policies, but they ought to praise him on issues of that they say they care about. The third reason I wrote the book was President Obama. If you follow President Obama's pronouncements, he takes great pride in reminding us how much he's like Ronald Reagan, how much he's like President Lincoln, and I wanted to hold the two up side by side and see exactly how he looked. And it's not a pretty picture. In every chapter, whether onshore, offshore, coal, strategic and critical minerals, Endangered Species Act, you name it, I talk about the Reagan record. I talk about what happened after Ronald Reagan left office. And then I talk about what's going on today. And frankly, it's not a pretty picture. Those are the reasons I wrote the book. I want to talk a little bit about the lessons, the takeaways, and obviously I hope people will buy the book. And if they buy the book and take a look at the book, I hope they'll go on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and post a review. But here are the three takeaways that that I think you learn from the book and why it's current today. And my first takeaway is the environmental community is no longer concerned about human beings. And that's really a stark difference, and this is a surprise to many people, given the rhetoric that's out there. And it's a break that happened during Reagan's lifetime. Reagan always regarded himself as an environmentalist. He loved the great outdoors. He loved to be outside. He loved to be on his ranch. He felt when he was on horseback in parks or rural areas, he was in special communion with the Lord. And what happened during Reagan's lifetime is the split of the environmentalists. The environmental community began, of course, with the conservationists, the Teddy Roosevelt, the John Muirs. And whether the concern was conservation, which is our U.S. forests or national forest are set aside, conserve, conservation meaning wise use, that is, use, the forests were set aside for water supply, for timber, and also for later on for recreation. And the realization that was we would use the fiber, and the idea being that human beings had a need for food and fiber and water, and we would use resources to provide for human need in that regard. At the same time, the preservationist community, which gave rise to our national parks and the first national park being Yellowstone, there was a sense that mankind also had a psychological, emotional, and spiritual need to be in God's great creation. and to be in special communion with God in those special places, and that those lands would be preserved for future generations to enjoy. And the classic battle between environmentalists was the battle over Het Hetchy, the dam in Yosemite National Park, after the earthquake in San Francisco. There was a desire by the people of San Francisco for a reliable water supply. They knew where they could put that dam. They would construct it in Yosemite National Park. And that caused a split between the conservation community and the preservation community. And it was not over whether we leave nature alone because of nature's need. It was whether or not we leave it alone because of human needs. In fact, I think it was John Muir who said, why flood Het Hetchy? You might as well flood the great cathedrals of the world as to flood that holy place where man needs. And so the battle in Congress was, what was the more important need, the need of San Franciscans for water or the needs of the people of San Francisco and California, in fact, the nation, to go to this Yosemite National Park and not see a dam? So that was the big battle. And then in the 60s and 70s, it's my view that the environmental community, the professional environmental groups, lost the bubble and stopped being concerned about human needs and became concerned about the needs of the planet. If you followed some of the rhetoric recently and some of the debates over hydraulic fracturing, you look at what's going on in upstate New York today, in contrast to what's going on in Pennsylvania with regard to the development of private property. I always thought the worst thing Yoko Ono ever did was destroy the Beatles. I'm now convinced the worst thing she's ever done is condemn the people of upstate New York to poverty, as she and her Hollywood friends prevent the development of those farmlands in upstate New York. The second takeaway is that the environmental community is today an arm of the Democratic Party. John O'Sullivan, the former editor of National Review, once opined that any organization not avowedly conservative becomes more liberal over time, and that certainly has been the case with the environmental community. I don't think I need to say anything more about that, but that certainly is a takeaway. And the third thing, and I think most disturbingly, is the way the media, and it began during the Reagan administration, the media has lost any sense of objectivity with regard to reporting of environmental issues. And we certainly have seen that with regard to global warming, global cooling, or climate change, whatever the word du jour is for the issue. But the media, which we always thought we could rely on perhaps to a greater or lesser degree to get the facts out, doesn't find a need to get the facts out. I explore in my book a couple of episodes, and one in particular, where a misrepresentation of something that a Department of Interior official did. Clearly, the statement in the record proved that what the media was reporting was not true. And yet, it continued to be reported as the truth from 1981 through about 2005, when someone over at powerlineblog.com reported the truth and got the news out. And I think that's the one positive aspect that we have with regard to the media. The mainstream media may not be reporting the truth on these important environmental issues, but we do have the internet, we do have the blogosphere, we do have people out there willing to put information out and report what is really going on. And I frankly think when you read my book and you look at what was going on with Reagan in 1980 and 81, I must say that 2013 certainly looks a lot like 1981. Tim?
Thank you, Perry, and I'm honored to be able to participate in the program today and offer some brief remarks on your outstanding book. Sagebrush Rebel tells the important story of the Reagan administration's battles with environmental extremists and their allies in the media. Perry has told this story masterfully, with attention to the real facts and the strong personalities involved. This battle was a significant part of the Reagan Revolution, and it raises lessons which are equally relevant today. And yet, as Perry mentioned, this story has largely been untold until now with the publication of this book. The issues over balancing the need for U.S. energy and mineral production with proper conservation and stewardship of our lands and water resources were not new in the 1980s, nor were they resolved then. In fact, in this country, they date back to at least the 1800s, and it's been an ongoing policy debate since that time. As Reagan stated and Perry reminds us, people are part of the ecosystem too. This was not really a radical position by President Reagan, yet the media at the time portrayed President Reagan and his appointees within the Interior Department and other agencies concerned with environmental issues as being the extremists in the policy debate. I was a staff attorney at the Interior Department during the middle part of the Reagan administration, so I saw these issues from a lower level than Perry was as a Deputy Assistant Secretary, but I certainly got a glimpse of these issues as they occurred at that time. The policy issues continue today with full force over a range of subjects such as hydraulic fracturing and the use of our abundant coal resources to cost-effectively generate electricity. And this policy debate is presented very forcefully in this book. In fact, I would go so far as suggesting that Ronald Reagan would heartily approve of this book. Rather than have you take my word for it, I will quote Reagan's Attorney General and close confidant, Ed Meese, and he has provided the following review of Sagebrush Rebel, which I'm sure Perry is very pleased with. He said, "Sagebrush Rebel is one of the most important, insightful, and inspirational books about Ronald Reagan's domestic policies since An American Life by President Reagan himself." So that is very high praise from a very knowledgeable expert on these issues. Another review on Perry's book comes from Mark Levin, who was chief of staff to Attorney General Ed Meese, and who also spent time in the Interior Solicitor's Office during the Reagan years. He stated, "Ronald Reagan, a lifelong conservationist and environmentalist, believed people are part of the ecosystem. That was heresy to those whom Reagan called environmental extremists, so they lie about his record. The truth is in Sagebrush Rebel." So that comes from Mark Levin. Now, of course, we all recall that Reagan was known as the great communicator, and to that extent, he had some benefits at communications that all of his appointees didn't always share. But Reagan would use humor to educate and make a point, and I thought I would offer a few examples that came to mind in connection with the issues in Perry's book, Sagebrush Rebel. Reagan had this to say regarding Democratic policies on the economy. He would say, his opponents say, "If something moves, tax it. If it still moves, regulate it. If it stops moving, subsidize it." Just think how true those points are in our current policy environment. On other occasions, Reagan would actually ad-lib jokes, as illustrated by this encounter with ABC's Sam Donaldson. Sam Donaldson had quite an aggressive style in press conferences that we don't often see today, and he said, "Mr. President, you've just blamed the current recession on President Carter and the Democrats in Congress, but don't you bear some responsibility too?" Reagan paused and reacted on the spot, said, "Well, Sam, I was a Democrat for the first half of my life, and so I suppose I do bear some responsibility." I was at a recent event where Ed Meese recently retold Reagan's favorite joke about an ordinary citizen in the Soviet Union. And Ed Meese said this was Reagan's all-time favorite joke. And it went like this. "Most ordinary citizens in the Soviet Union could not own a car, but one citizen, Vladimir, had decided to scrimp and save for 10 years so he could buy a car. One day, after a decade, he had saved enough rubles so that he went to the Soviet bureaucrat with the National Car department to pay his money to get the car. Vladimir paid his money and was issued a permit to obtain the car. And Vladimir asked, "But when will I get my car?" He was told he could come back and take delivery in 5 years on January 17th. Vladimir was greatly saddened. Then he asked, "Will that be morning or afternoon on January 17th? The Soviet bureaucrat asked, "What difference does that make?" Vladimir said, "I have a plumber scheduled to come that morning." I suspect the reason this was Reagan's favorite joke is that it illustrated the inefficiency and absurdity of a society ruled by near total government control, where nearly everything required a permit. And so during Reagan's tenure, he pushed to reduce government regulatory burdens and expedite U.S. Interior Department approvals of mineral leasing and project permitting actions, both onshore and on the Outer Continental Shelf. Sadly, we have steadily lost that policy emphasis over the past 25 years, as federal mineral permitting and leasing delays and uncertainties increasingly have impeded private investments and jobs, as Perry details in Sagebrush Rebel. The recent amazing boom in U.S. oil and gas production is the notable exception, but this wonderful and unexpected phenomenon over the past 6 years is occurring on private lands, mostly subject to state regulation, not on our vast federal lands, and Perry's book details this as well. Perry explains in Sagebrush Rebel that Reagan was really a moderate conservationist in the mold of Gifford Pinchot and Teddy Roosevelt. Reagan loved the outdoors and took many steps to protect our lands and resources, and these aspects of his policies are detailed in the book as well. Reagan understood in particular the importance of allowing development of the vast natural resources on our federal lands, likely because of his 8-year tenure as governor of California, a relatively typical western state where nearly 48% of the land base is owned by the federal government. Reagan understood that our vast natural resources were vitally important to domestic energy and mineral production and jobs, and that's why he said, "Count me as a sagebrush rebel." And those are my thoughts on Perry's book, and I think we're going to take questions from the audience at this point.
Indeed we are. Thank you very much, gentlemen. In a moment, we should all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for our expert today, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And while we're waiting to see who rings in with a question, let me make a couple announcements. Most of you probably realize that the Federalist Society National Lawyers Convention has just ended this past Saturday, and we now have available on our website nearly all of the convention video. So you can go to our website, that's www.fed-soc.org, and access virtually all the Federalist Society convention video. As to upcoming Teleforum conference calls, tomorrow we have a special Courthouse Steps edition of Teleforum at 3 p.m. when we'll be looking at the limits of labor law, Unite Here versus Mulhall, a case argued last week in the court. And then on Wednesday at 2 p.m., we'll be discussing civil asset forfeiture. But today, again, we're talking to Perry Penley and Mr. Timothy Crum about the new book, Sagebrush Rebels. But with that, let's go to our first caller. We have just one caller, and then our lines will be open. If you have a question, again, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our first caller.
Hi, this is Roger Clegg with the Center for Equal Opportunity, and I wanted to thank Perry for his wonderful book and all the other great things he's done over the years with Mountain States. I was going to ask both him and the commenter to elaborate on what they think should be done going forward. It's not a altogether inspiring picture of how far down we've gone over the years. Could you elaborate, Perry, on what we can do to set things right?
Right, Roger. Thank you very much. Tim is absolutely right when he talks about this hydraulic fracturing miracle that we have, and It really is an energy miracle. I remember Jimmy Carter predicted that by 1990 we'd run out of natural gas. That's why he wanted to turn to coal. We had run out of natural gas by 1990. Today we have a glut in natural gas. And so it is an energy miracle. It's an economic miracle. What it's done in Pennsylvania, for example, I saw a study the other day said 70% of all the new jobs and economic growth in Pennsylvania are directly attributable to hydraulic fracturing that's going on there. And it's an environmental miracle because as natural gas is more available, some of the energy sources that release more CO2 to the environment are displaced. As Tim pointed out, this is occurring primarily, or only, I should say, on state and private lands. The one federal land area where there is great potential for oil, not gas, development is in the Santos Monterey in California. Experts say that it's if you took Bakken and Eagle Ford and doubled it and added a billion, it'd still be less than Santos Monterey. That's a federal area, and what's happened there? Well, environmentalists filed a lawsuit. Federal judge enjoined activity because of NEPA violations, and the Obama administration stopped issuing leases. So that's what's happening when we try to develop federal lands. Let me focus on two specific issues, and one is involved in hydraulic fracturing. Talk about killing the goose that laid the golden egg. Secretary Salazar at the Department of Interior, Secretary Jewell now, are trying to promulgate BLM regulations to regulate hydraulic fracturing. Bear in mind, this is something that's been done for 60 years. It's regulated by the states, well regulated by the states, and yet the BLM wants to add another layer of bureaucracy to it. One commenter on these regulations said it's a solution in search of a problem. The BLM in its comments when it issued the regulations or published the draft of the regulations said, well, we've not been able to identify any environmental disaster that this would prevent, but we're going to put these out anyway. Western Energy Alliance did a study. They think it'll cost about $365 million a year. It'll cost $1 million for every new well. And because if you get a permit, what's going to happen is it's subject to a lawsuit, and so there we go. So they really have to stop doing what they're doing right now, which is imposing new regulations on a really remarkable, well-operating machine out there and finding energy. And let me just close this segment in this rather long answer by quoting something from my book. One of the men primarily responsible for the Bakken is a man by the name of Harold Hamm, who's the head of Continental Resources. He had the opportunity, reports the Wall Street Journal, to meet President Obama back in 2011. And the one message he wanted to convey to President Obama was the remarkable transformation that had taken place in the oil patch in Harold Hamm's lifetime. Because he believed, Hamm did, that it was absolutely mind-boggling what the technological advances that had happened. And so that's the message you convey to the president. The president brushed him aside and said, no, we've got to go with green energy. Secretary Chu here tells me in 5 years we'll have a battery that'll replace all oil and gas resources. And Hamm's response to that was, even if you believe that nonsense, why in the world would you want to do away with the economic benefits of the oil and gas industry? So I don't see any great change, the kind of change we need on the near horizon, Roger.
That's a very good response, Perry. I'll just offer a few other thoughts. It is a daunting challenge that we find ourselves faced with at this time on these issues, as we've been acknowledging. And I suppose looking at Ronald Reagan as an example, we need to first be optimistic and believe that we can prevail on these issues. We've got the facts on our side. We've got the science on our side. We've got the policy arguments on our side. So we've got to marshal the arguments and put forward this our side of this debate as Reagan did, and he faced the Soviet Union as a seemingly invincible enemy and was able to overcome that. So with some optimism, hopefully we can prevail and get these issues elevated in the political debate, and make sure the trade associations and companies that are involved understand the importance of engaging the public and the political leadership on these issues.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you, Perry.
Yeah, thank you, Roger. We've got three questions pending, so let's now go to our next caller.
Good afternoon. This is David Fredley. I'm retired Forest Service. Thank you, Tim and Perry. I look forward to reading the book. This relates to the last question, and that is I kind of see coming down the pike the use of the Antiquities Act by this president in a big way to take more lands, federal lands, out of development. I suspect you may see the same thing. What do we do?
Well, you're absolutely right, and this is one of the great frustrations for me, and I talk about it in my book. Ronald Reagan took a lot of heat for his policies on wilderness. As I said, he signed more wilderness laws than anybody else. I've taken heat from conservative friends for bragging on that. The fact of the matter is the only way a lot of the western states were able to get non-wilderness lands or lands that shouldn't be in wilderness areas released from a de facto moratorium or a de facto wilderness designation was to have a Wilderness Act approved for their state and get those other lands released. Reagan did veto two wilderness bills, one in Florida that would be incredibly costly to the American people, and the other one in Montana because of objections from the Republican side of that delegation up there. It was not a bipartisan bill. He said he would only sign bipartisan bills. And so what Reagan did was if a congressional delegation wanted to designate lands in the state as wilderness, then if they were unanimous in that, then the president would sign the bill if it weren't too costly to the American people out of their pocketbooks. Compare that with what Bill Clinton did in his abuse of the Antiquities Act, where he simply decided to overrule the will of the people of, say, Montana or the people of Utah in designating vast monuments, national monuments. And I frankly believe, as an attorney and as a student of this area, that the Antiquities Act for that purpose is unconstitutional, simply because the Antiquities Act was passed in 1906. It related to antiquities. It didn't relate to wild and scenic rivers. It didn't relate to endangered species. Those issues were affected later by, say, the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act or, say, the Endangered Species Act. And yet you'd have a presidential proclamation signed by Bill Clinton says, well, I'm setting aside this area because it's got endangered species or it's got this unique wild river. Well, if Congress wanted to designate those rivers or those species, well, Congress was certainly able to do so. If the president wanted to take action under those laws, he could. And yet Clinton did not take any abuse from the media on doing something was very unconstitutional. And in fact, if you remember, when Bill Clinton designated the Escalante Grand Staircase in Utah that killed a massive coal mine that would have been very productive and important to the people of Utah, he didn't do it in Utah. He did it in Arizona at the edge of the Grand Canyon. And I have the same fears with regard to President Obama. Sally Jewell has been traveling the country, bragging up on how the president's on the verge of using the Antiquities Act authority simply because she and he are tired of waiting for the state's delegations to do what the states want to do on these issues. Well, that's not the proper answer. The answer with regard to wilderness areas and designation of parks and set-asides in states should turn upon the wishes of the people of those states and not an autocratic decree from the President of the United States. I'm very concerned that that's going to happen. I hope somebody will challenge it, and I hope it gets a better opportunity to be heard in court than the last challenges.
I'll just briefly add that it is a serious issue regarding the likelihood of further Antiquities Act designations, and there should be a legal strategy as well as a policy strategy with the Congress. There was the policy by Secretary Salazar about 2 years ago to have a new Secretary of Wildlands policy. And surprising to the conventional wisdom, the Congress was able to pass appropriations restrictions on the implementation of that policy because it was very unpopular in the West. So perhaps something could be done along those lines. And the other thing to keep in mind is that when these designations are made, they can, in appropriate cases, be reversed. So we need to be thinking about that as well.
We've got one caller on the line at this point with a question. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller. It looks like that one caller. Oh, here we go. Hold on 1 second, please.
This is Jerry Haggard. I also wanted to congratulate Perry on his publication of Sagebrush Rebels, and Tim on his environmental litigation. But my question comes from my perception about the demographics of the United States electorate. And it seems to me that nothing meaningful will change in environmental laws, public land laws, Endangered Species Act with that demographics. And Perry and Tim, I have not yet heard a solution to that voter demographics situation that we have.
Well, Jerry, thank you for your kind words, and it is dismaying. The low information, being in the era of the low information voter, is very troubling, and not just on environmental issues, but across the board. On Obamacare, economic recovery, the stimulus package, Dodd-Frank, you name an issue. It's very hard to get traction with regard to what's going on. I think the only time we started to get a little bit of traction on some of the abuses going on is the NSA spying and whether or not people were having their conversations and their internet traffic interfered with. I do think there is a light on the horizon with regard to these economic and environmental issues. I reference in my book a poll done by Gallup. It's a poll Gallup has done for about 25 years now, and it asks a simple question: what's more important, the economy or the environment? And for 25 years, you wouldn't be surprised to learn that the environment was more important. People rated that the more important issue. Of course, they were doing that at a time when the economy was booming. And I talk about in my book Reagan's view. He talked about the Soviet Union, and he said, my philosophy on the Soviet Union is we win, they lose. And I think he had a similar strategy with regard to what he called environmental extremists or modern-day Luddites. He thought that he would transcend them. We would transcend them, and their sort of neo-Malthusian notions. And the reason that didn't happen was because the economy took off, and so all of the demands by environmental groups with regard to this set aside or that set aside or that forbearance didn't have a big cost component to it. Don't mind that coal in Utah. Don't mind that gold and silver deposit in Montana. Don't cut those trees in the Pacific Northwest. Well, it's a really relatively small cost to the economy. But in 2009, the Gallup poll, those two lines crossed, and the public's response was that the economy was more important. And simply, during a time when people are looking for jobs, especially in the young people, I saw a statistic the other day that said that one out of every four grown children in New Jersey is living at home with mom and dad or the grandparents. And I think that this is a very helpful sign. I think also Tim is right when he talks about the people learning about the benefits of hydraulic fracturing. You look at the young people in the farming communities in Pennsylvania who have been able to leave the big city, go back with mom and dad onto the farm, and pick up where mom and dad left off, and preserve that farm that's been in four or five or six generations, and keep it in the family farm simply because of the benefits of hydraulic fracturing and the way these little communities are being saved. And so I think that there's a good story to be told, and that we can persuade the low information voter, and certainly the young people who are looking for work and would like to have productive work and not be on the dole, that we've got the right message. So I'm hopeful, Jerry.
I think that the poll data that Perry has cited and discussed in his book on this point is encouraging, and I think it may well be this boom in the U.S. oil and gas production that helps illustrate to the public and even to the media and government leaders the more clear connection between production of our domestic natural resources and jobs in this country. I can remember talking to a Clinton administration official at the BLM who expressed the view that, well, the reason U.S. Metallic mineral production was down was because all the deposits here were mined out and the companies were leaving. And, of course, the oil and gas industry, a fair amount of people in the oil and gas industry had that view in this country 25 years ago, only to now have this rediscovery of the vast oil, shale, and shale gas deposits here in this country. And, of course, with metallic mineral production, there are plenty of large deposits here, but they're being blocked largely by government policy and ENGO advocacy. So hopefully our public is going to become more aware of that, and with the oil and gas boom is the largest phenomenon that's occurred in this country in decades to make that case. And I hope that as that case is made, it won't be confined just to the oil and gas sector, but to more broadly make that point regarding U.S. natural resources in general that can be produced for economic benefit.
Tim, let me add on to what you said in another example of how we have the past occurring again. Jimmy Carter, for those of you who have forgotten, Jimmy Carter's big push was on synfuels and the Energy Mobilization Board, and how he was going to take control. The federal government was going to run things from Washington, and where he's going to create all this energy and set NEPA aside, set the Endangered Species Act aside, and boy, it would be great. And the Western governors, and it wasn't Republicans, Western Democrat governors raised holy hell. In fact, there's a book published by Governor Lamb after he left office called The Angry West. And if you were to read The Angry West, you think I wrote it. It was very strong about what was going on by the Carter administration and by Cecil Andrus. Well, now let's fast forward to what's going on today and think about all the billions of dollars we pour down this green technology rat hole. You can't turn on your internet in the morning and not see another story about another high-tech firm with billions and billions of dollars of government backing shutting down at a cost of millions to the public. And right up the road here in Loveland, Colorado, we have a facility that's not only shut down at a cost of billions to the American public, it's an environmental hazard. And we have the cure. It's like Reagan once said, why don't we try something new for a change? Why don't we try the marketplace?
And Perry, building on that point, we see with the hydraulic fracturing horizontal drilling phenomenon, I mean, that is a testament to the private sector, and that has been the free market at its finest, proving those technologies and implementing them over the past decade, which really hardly anybody saw coming 6 or 7 years ago. And somebody just sent me an email, a good friend of mine who's listening, and pointed out that our states really are the best incubators for ideas and new activities, and we're seeing that with the hydraulic fracturing and horizontal drilling, where that activity is flourishing in states such as Pennsylvania and North Dakota, and Texas and New Mexico and elsewhere, Wyoming as well. And then we can see that other states are failing to allow it to occur without sound basis, such as New York, and their citizens are suffering.
That's absolutely right, Tim. And you talk about the states. The states are, I mentioned a minute ago, the BLM regulations or proposed regulations on hydraulic fracturing and getting another level of permitting done by the BLM. It's not just the oil patch that's filing comments against that, but state governors are also filing comments. I know my governor from Wyoming, Governor Matt Mead, has filed very strong comments. And in addition to the governors, Indian tribes are opposing it because they want to be part of this economic miracle. They believe that their lands possess the same opportunities, and they simply do not want the BLM coming in and telling them, you're going to need our permission.
Well, Perry, that reminds me of a quote from James Watt that I don't think you included in your book, and that was, he said that we don't have to go to the Soviet Union to see the failures of socialism. All we have to do is look at our own Indian reservations in this country.
Well, I did have it. It is.
Oh, you had that.
It's in a footnote. I've got, as Tim, as you know, I got a 1,234 footnotes spread over 193 pages. So no surprise that you missed that. But I certainly did talk about that. It was it was regarded as a misstep, and in fact, President Reagan did Jim Watt one better. He went to the Soviet Union and repeated it virtually the same thing.
Well, I confess I haven't read all of the footnotes, although I've read many of them, and I commend them to the audience.
Gentlemen, let me interject. Rather, this is Dean Reuter. We've got another question pending, so with your permission, we'll take another call.
Hello, this is Bob Davis in Maine. My comment and question are outside the scope of the book, but it occurs to me that Ronald Reagan did more than probably any other human being for the health of the planet and the environment by defeating the Soviet Union. And I'm wondering, am I way off base on that, or do you have any thoughts on it?
Well, I've always thought, that famous song, Abraham, Martin, and John, really ought to be Abraham, Martin, and Ron. If you remember the lyrics from the song, they freed a lot of people. And the great thing that Ronald Reagan did was, of course, bring down the Soviet Union. I don't know from a standpoint, from an environmental standpoint or an energy standpoint, but one of the things that Reagan did, and it explored a little bit in my book, it explored a great length in other books, is that he worked together with the Saudis in a way to bankrupt the Soviet Union, because he realized that every time the price of oil went up, billions of dollars went into the Soviet treasury and prepared them to do not just the satellite wars against us, but also economic war against us and resource war against us in Africa. And he brought the Soviet Union to its knees. I don't know about the economic, environmental, and energy consequences of that, but from the standpoint of freedom, it was just a miraculous thing, and he certainly deserves every bit of credit for doing it. I think there's an attempt by the left today to say, oh, Mikhail Gorbachev did it. He was such a good guy that he put an end to it. He didn't put an end to it willingly. Ronald Reagan put him to his knees and made it happen, along with the Pope and Margaret Thatcher.
From what I understood, and perhaps this is off base, the collectivist economies of Eastern Europe had pretty much devastated the environment, and there's been some recovery and some attention given to the environment that usually is done by countries of more democratic persuasion. And, perhaps that's wrong, and perhaps there hasn't really been any big change, or there wasn't any devastation. I'm not sure.
I think you're exactly right that there were terrible adverse effects on the environment as a result of the Soviet policies, which were not responsive to their people, and that is something that Reagan can be credited with, along with Pope John Paul II, as Perry said, and Prime Minister Thatcher together. And as Perry points out in the book, one of Reagan's strategies to help defeat the Soviet Union and to promote U.S. national security was to increase our domestic energy production, and that was one of his goals. And to do that, he knew he had to lessen the regulatory burden and allow the free market to work.
Thank you.
Well, gentlemen, it looks like we're out of questions. I want to give each of you maybe an opportunity, since we have about 5 minutes left, to express any final thoughts you might have. Mr. McCrum, you want to go first, and then we'll hear a final word from Mr. Finley.
Well, it's been a fun discussion, and appreciate the interaction with Perry and the callers. I think we do face significant challenges here. The opponents to U.S. natural resource production have only increased in their stridency over the past few decades, and we need to read the lessons from this book and put them into practice in the immediate future.
Mr. Penley, final thoughts?
Yeah, Ronald Reagan, every time we learn more about him, we are amazed by what a remarkable man he was. He truly believed something that was on his desk. There's no telling the amount of good that can be accomplished if no one cares who gets the credit. And as has been pointed out recently, Reagan never felt the need to demonstrate how smart he was or how much he knew. He knew what he knew. He knew who he was, and he was very comfortable in his own shoes, which I think was one of the great benefits of having a man who had been so successful in another career decide later in his life, to become president of the United States. And he had mastered these issues. He had very strong views. This wasn't something he came to willy-nilly, but he had thought things out. For example, with regard to energy issues, he said, number one, the energy supply in this country is not a monopoly. He said, number two, that most of the discoveries are made by the independents, and that's the proof of the pudding is what Harold Hamm with Continental Resources has done in North Dakota in the Bakken. And he said, finally, number three, Reagan, that the energy supplies would come in the future from unconventional technologies, and that certainly is what happened with hydraulic fracturing. Reagan was very farsighted, and the economic miracle that's going on today would not be a surprise to him. Also, what would not be a surprise to him is what's happening in the White House and in Congress with regard to the regulations and the policies that are essentially attempting to cripple this really amazing thing that's going on in the oil patch. And you wonder why, like Harold Hamm said, was so surprised when he got to the White House and found out their views and was stunned by it. And they just have a different vision for the country, and they simply believe that the government knows best and the government could control, that we live in short supply, and that it has to be carefully parceled out by the government, and that we have to get used to poverty and scarcity, and that wasn't Reagan's views at all. He believed that we can solve our problems. The government's not going to solve problems. As Reagan said, the government is not the solution. The government is the problem. And certainly we're seeing that that's the case today, as state after state that's willing to be creative with regard to these natural resource issues the way Reagan was is benefiting greatly by it, and it's the one bright spot in our economy. I just say in closing that if you like Ronald Reagan, you'll love Sagebrush Rebel. And if you wonder what's going on all these issues today, what would Reagan have done, what did Reagan do, well, it's all in Sagebrush Rebel, and I commend it to your attention, and I do hope those of you who read it will go to Amazon, go to Barnes & Noble, and post a comment. I appreciate the Federalist Society giving me this opportunity.
Well, let me in turn thank both of you. This is Dean Reuter thanking author William Perry Penley for his thoughts today. He's the author of Sagebrush Rebel, which is available at the locations he mentioned. Also, there's a link to it on our Federalist Society website. To our audience, I invite you to join us for our next Teleforum conference call tomorrow at 3 p.m. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.